Welcome to Voice of Albion with Paul Hickman on the White Network.
Weeks of simmering racial tension in Oldham finally erupted last night as more than 500 Asian youths fought pitched battles with riot police. Armed with bricks and petrol bombs and aiming fireworks at police, the mob rampaged across the town's Brodick estate throughout the night and into the early hours of this morning.
But how did the far right tip a relatively peaceful, multicultural community into race-hate chaos? Less than 20 years ago, Oldham was overwhelmingly white. Now Asians make up 11% of the population, and the two communities rarely mix.
How are you?
Nanu Mia has lived here since 1984.
Is it very segregated?
I mean, it is, in a way, it is segregated. But what can you do? It's just the way it is. Do you understand? I mean, I don't like it. I'm sure there's a lot of people around here don't like it.
In 2001, racial tension had been building in Oldham. The town had gained a reputation as the country's race-hate capital, thanks to controversial crime figures published by the police, which showed an increase in Asian-on-white attacks. It was the perfect climate for the far right to enact their campaign of provocation.
You have to remember that 2001 was an election year, and an election in which immigration was very high on the agenda. And for many white communities, and also a large portion of the media, the whole concept of Asian youth, immigration, asylum seekers was rolled into one generic fear of dark skin.
This fear was given a focus when, in April, a 76-year-old war veteran, Walter Chamberlain, was assaulted by Asian thugs. The story made national headlines.
Apart from the severity of the injuries, this attack has shaken Oldham because it came just days after a group of Asian youths were reported to be threatening to set up no-go areas in the town where whites would not be allowed.
The far-right British National Party pounced on the controversy. On St George's Day, their leader, Nick Griffin, announced his intention to stand in Oldham West in the forthcoming general election.
So the kind of the racial problems that have been in Oldham made you want to vote BNP?
BNP, yeah.
What did BNP offer, do you think?
I'm not sure, really.
This town is run by Asians. It is run by Asians for Asians, to the exclusion of the whites.
By May, members of the far right were making regular weekend visits to Oldham in a clear attempt to destabilise the town's fragile peace. The local community and the anti-Nazi League came out to protest against them. But although police tried to keep things under control, the Asian youth were steadily rising to the bait. Early afternoon on Saturday, May the 26th, a gang of white hooligans on the way to Oldham Football Ground decided to take a different route to the stadium.
Rather than taking that route, they actually came down that route, the Charlton Way, just behind the houses, the Charlton Way.
Which is pretty much a predominantly Asian
Asians,
area.
Yeah. Well, you've got majority, you've got shops, groceries, you've got
Yes, there's a little Asian community, and you were saying that this diversion of the football fans was a provocative, decided to do.
Somebody, I think, saw...
Deliberately provocative.
It was planned.
Nanu was in the community centre when the hooligans passed by.
The girls upstairs are screaming, so we thought, whoa, what's going on? So we rushed upstairs, and so they're all curled up in a corner. It's like giving support to one another, and they were in tears,
scared.
And they were scared so much. So we looked through the window, and we see there's hundreds of, you know, like, white men's, you know, like, shouting out Nazi signs. We've seen their hands up and saying, Pakis out.
They were all coming down this way, that way. They're all running, about 250 to 300 people. And one of them shouted, "Oh, Hussein Brothers!" Noticed the sign. Hussein Brothers started kicking the door.
The perception is that it's people from outside have come into the area and provoked people.
If they come down, vandalising and breaking our shops and beating us up, then we have a duty to defend ourselves.
Within hours, there was a full-scale riot. The police, sensing trouble, had successfully diverted the football fans away from the area, but this just left them facing a volatile and fired up group of Asian youth. Nanu tried to defuse the situation by talking to the police.
So I went down and said, listen, don't do what you plan, don't attack this, they'll go, just give us, allow us some more time.
Yeah.
So we came back up, and after about 10 minutes, the police from all directions they attacked.
Police were injured during the confrontations, reinforcements had to be drafted.
Across town, a group of whites attacked an Asian family.
When you got people coming into your house, knocking your door and dragging your family out and beating them up, you got to put a stop to it, and this is it.
Fueled by fear and rumour, violence exploded to the surface. By nightfall, the whole of Oldham seemed to be rioting. Asians attacked the local newspaper, which they perceived to be racist, and a local pub, ironically named the Live and Let Live.
They come in, attacked all my customers, with bricks, stools, glasses, bottles, whatever they had their hands on.
But the most hatred seemed to be reserved for the police. Like Oldham, Burnley has a growing Asian population and a large pool of disenchanted white voters susceptible to racist scaremongering.
In the June 2001 general election, the Burnley BNP had won 11% of the vote, leaving the Asian community feeling vulnerable and far more likely to respond to any provocation from the far right.
On the morning of Saturday, June the 23rd, a gang of white youths attacked an Asian taxi driver with a hammer, fracturing his cheekbone. As rumours of further racial violence spread across the town, gangs of white and Asian youth took to the streets.
It's really frightening. It seemed like, you know, a war going on, you know.
Absolutely, it was terrible. Absolutely frightening.
I think it was just an excuse to indulge in some mindless vandalism and mindless violence without fear of retribution.
By Sunday, word had got out and more white guys poured in wanting a piece of the action. This exclusive police footage shot on the Sunday shows a gang roaming the streets looking for trouble. Andrew Porter, a self-confessed hooligan, was part of this mob.
We got 40 lads together. Yeah. Went up to give them a round, but it were too well policed. So then we made our way back to Burnley Town Centre and tried to get into the Asian area where 200 Asians were waiting for us.
Duke of York missiles been thrown.
And then going down a few shop windows, started going through. Police moved us on. The police then, all of a sudden, the police charged us into the pub doorway. See, they have a tactic, police. Two right shields in front of you, right, two officers there, one officer stood behind, hitting up head with sharp edge at shields, you know what I mean?
That's how they lose it.
Well, you don't feel it in a fight, you feel it day after. Right, police don't like nicking you, do they? They just want it. You know what I mean? They want it as much as you.
Andrew Porter wasn't the only person to feel the sharp edge of a riot shield that weekend. In a massive PR blunder, the police also arrested a senior member of the Commission for Racial Equality.
The police were moving forward in kind of military operation style with their riot shields, and as I turned round, I was near face to face with one of the officers. And I said to him, hey, look, it's okay, there's no problem here. And he just lifted his riot shield with the edge and went smash straight into my face.
Violence escalated on Sunday, with property being destroyed on both sides, including a white-owned pub firebombed by Asians and an Asian restaurant firebombed by whites. Andrew Porter was arrested and sentenced for 3 years for his role in the riots, although, to this day, he insists he has no connection with the far right.
So when I got done for riots,
yeah. They
called me a Nazi scum who voted BNP. Yeah. And I never voted in my life, you know what I mean? So I don't know where that label comes from, because I'm not British, I won't vote BNP, I'm English.
Do you respect the Asians?
No.
Okay.
No, not
at all. I mean as a mob, because it's not like, when I was...
They stick together, I'll give them that, they stick together well.
In July, rumours spread that Bradford was to be the next city to suffer a far-right invasion. Alarmed by reports that young Asians were tooling up in preparation, community leaders made a desperate plea to their youth.
I'm extremely anxious about the events in Oldham and Burnley, and I'm quite sure that the National Front in Bradford want to spark something similar up. And my message to Bradford people, especially Bradford young people, is don't be provoked.
On Saturday, July the 7th, word spread that the NF were planning to march into the city centre. Asians and whites joined forces in an anti-Nazi demo.
What they want is a divided Bradford.
They've been calm with the police and everything. It's an excellent way of showing that Bradford young people are not troublemakers or will not cause trouble in their own city.
But community leaders had spoken too soon. Trouble was, quite literally, round the corner. Although the NF march had been banned, some recognised fascists turned up, and by 4:30 p.m, a peaceful demo had turned nasty.
Unfortunately, whilst three young youth were walking up the road past the bar, they were assaulted by a group of 15 lads who made comments of racial abuse and said, "Here's the National Front." One young person, about 22-year-old, is in hospital with head injuries.
Scuffles broke out between Asians and whites, and this shocking attack ended in a brutal stabbing.
He's been stabbed.
He's been stabbed.
Once the whites looking for trouble had dispersed, it was the police once again who found themselves confronted by the anger of Asian youths.
Concerned about having a riot in the city centre, the police then started to drive the Asian youth back up towards Manningham.
In Manningham, a predominantly Asian area of the city, the two sides squared up. Very quickly, it turned into a full-scale riot.
Young people felt that the police had failed to protect their community and they had to do something about it. The Asians felt that the police were protecting the BNP. Well, that was not the case.
It was very much a sort of almost like a war of attrition. The police would push the protesters back a few yards, protesters would come back with their missiles, and the police were making very, very slow progress in getting them back. In those early moments, you know, I think we were quite frightened, really. We thought the police were not going to be able to hold the line, and the missiles were starting to sort of go over the top of the police and amongst us.
I was in the heart of it. I could see the bricks flying over police lines. I could see petrol bombs going off. I could see cars being rolled in. Everything.
Word spread, and within hours, Asian kids from all over the north were driving to Bradford to join the action. West Yorkshire Police had to call in reinforcements from 8 different forces, but this in itself brought its own problems.
We were trying to calm the situation down, but they were bull charging us. They were doing charges towards the community leaders, because there was a lot of officers who were brought in from other areas who didn't understand the community of Bradford.
1,000 youths battled with 500 police officers. It was the worst rioting on mainland Britain for over 2 decades.
As a journalist, I have to say, actually, it was quite exciting. The adrenaline was running. You knew that you were in the middle of a very, very big story, and although the repercussions were extremely serious, you didn't think any more at that stage. You just got on with the job, basically. From some of the officers that I observed, most of them, they were probably getting the same sort of feeling as journalists were. Clearly, their adrenaline was running as well.
As night fell, the rioters' tactics grew increasingly sophisticated.
What is happening now is that the police in the front line are being blinded by powerful lights, so they cannot see the missiles being thrown at them.
This mountain of rubble is all that's left of a local successful BMW dealership. The rioters attacked the showroom, liberated the BMWs and set fire to them to push them into the lines of police and to create barricades across the road.
The orgy of violence lasted 11 hours with property all across Manningham being destroyed. The local Labour Club,
which had been here, was firebombed whilst people were inside. As you can see, there's nothing left but, like, battered remnants of the light fittings and molten concrete.
A series of riots in northern England have brought race relations to breaking point in some areas. What's to be done? The far-right parties in Britain want an immediate ban on non-white immigration and encouragement for non-whites to return to their country of ethnic origin. Today I'm talking to the head of the British National Party, which advocates those policies. Why are they so intolerant? Nick Griffin, welcome to the programme.
Hello.
Louis Farrakhan, the controversial leader of the Nation of Islam, is coming to Britain. You're glad about that, aren't you?
I wouldn't say I'm glad about it, but I'd say he's got a right to come here. I think trying to keep him out was going to inflame tensions. If he comes here, people have to listen to what he's got to say, and at the end of it, he goes away again.
A man who's expressed anti-Semitic, deeply offensive to some people, anti-Semitic comments in the past.
It's like some of his comments have been deeply offensive to many people in this country, offensive to Jews, offensive to white people, but still, he's only talking about things. If he's here inciting violence or attacking people, he should be thrown out. But if he's here to talk and debate, there's no harm in people listening.
You care whether he's offensive to Jews? I mean, some of your positions are pretty offensive to Jews, aren't
they? I don't think they are, but...
denial of the Holocaust, for instance?
I don't deny the Holocaust.
You don't? What do you deny, then?
I deny that it's right. There's something that happens 60 years ago, which my father fought against, and many people in this country fought against, is used as a club with which to beat people. So that if you say, well, we think the multiracial society isn't working, oh, well, you're a Nazi, you want to gas people.
So you've changed your views about it, because your magazines have consistently called it a hollow hoax.
I've used the phrase once. It's not just people like the British National Party who've said that it's wrong that this should be used in modern politics.
No, but you've changed your view here, haven't you?
A lot of people have changed their views on this, yes.
So you now accept that the Holocaust took place?
I've never denied that there was a Holocaust, that large numbers of Jews perished just because they were Jews. There's no doubt about that.
You said it was a conspiracy, a mixture of wartime allied propaganda and all sorts of
things. There's a lot of propaganda in anything connected with war. The facts and fictions of the Second World War and the Holocaust are very confused. They're now being studied mainly by Jews, people like Norman Finkelstein.
Nobody's confused about the fact that 6 million Jews died. Countries all over the world have accepted it. There's a few dissidents on the side, and David Irving, who your party pastors also supported, comprehensively rubbish,
no,
hasn't
it? No, there's Jewish academics like Norman Finkelstein. Recently published a book called The Holocaust Industry. Now, he's not denying, just as I'm not denying, that large numbers of Jews suffered and were murdered just because they were Jews.
6 million Jews in the gas chambers. You accept that now, do you?
There's no question that there was large numbers. I don't think anyone accepts 6 million. It's described in the Holocaust Museum in Yad Vashem as being symbolic.
So you've given up your support for David Irving as well, the historian.
I don't support David Irving.
Your party hosted evenings for him, and party leaders have attended his seminars. In 92, your party hosted an evening for him.
That was before I was even in the British National Party.
Yeah, but it's still your party.
Yes, well, we...
I'm putting this to you that your views have changed substantially, then. The views of the party have changed substantially.
I would say that there's certainly been a reassessment of it, and looking at it, this is now something in the last century, which my father was in the RAF fighting against the Nazis.
What's that got to do with the Holocaust?
I would say that for people in the BBC to come and use this as a 60-year-old stick to beat me when we should be talking about...
Why are we using it as a stick? I'm merely trying to elicit what your views are on this.
Yes.
You're very defensive about it.
But I feel that it's wrong, and which bit is wrong? I'm defensive about it because...
Which bit is wrong, Mr. Griffith?
It's wrong that this issue, which is a matter for historians now, and is the last century, and courts, as happened with David Irving, it is wrong that this issue is used as a moral club to stop sensible debate about what is happening in our country.
But it's people in the far right who brought it up, who've been questioning it. You can't say then it's wrong for people to combat
it. Well, I haven't been questioning it.
Well, you talked about the hollow hoax
for many years. Just as Norman Finkelstein, a Jewish academic, says there's a Holocaust industry. There is a racket of people who make money out of being Jewish. Not Jews, ordinary Jews, like the incident in Switzerland where the Swiss... Swiss banks and insurance companies paid huge sums of money over because they hadn't given money to Jewish survivors.
You were found guilty.
None of that money has gone to ordinary Jews.
Mr. Griffin,
all in the hands of Zionist organizations.
Mr. Griffin,
that is a racket.
You were convicted in 1998 of distributing material likely to incite racial hatred, and you were given a 9-month suspended sentence. You said you were convicted under a law in which telling the truth was no defense.
That's what the law says, yes.
Well, that's not strictly true. I mean, what the jury had to decide here was whether your magazine contained material that was abusive or insulting. And they decided that it did.
Yes, but the judge had to tell them under the law that the fact everything I was saying was true was no defense, and I think that's a bad law.
The question that the jury was asked to consider was, did you intend the magazine to stir up racial hatred? Even you conceded it was possible, at your trial, you conceded it was possible that people of non-white race might be insulted.
Yes, I did concede that, and I also said that...
So you can see why the jury came to the conclusion they did, then?
The reason the jury came to the conclusion they did was it was a multiracial biased jury.
Because it was multiracial, it was biased?
Against a member of the British National Party, yes. They would have convicted a pig wearing a BNP rosette.
Hardly, they convicted you, didn't they?
They did indeed.
Are you a pig wearing a rosette?
Maybe, but they would have convicted me had I been talking about block drains, because it was put to them, this is the British National Party, these are bad people, they're politically incorrect.
So it was a biased jury and you didn't get justice?
I got justice in that the judge, once the jury had made a decision to convict me, the judge acknowledged that he believed that I hadn't intended to incite racial hatred, that I was acting under good intentions.
He left it up to the jury. He said what the jury had to decide.
Yes, but in his summing up afterwards, no, sorry, not the summing up, in his sentencing, he said that the jury had convicted me. He said that he thought that I'd strayed across the line which the law makes inadvertently, that I was acting with good intentions, and because I was acting with good intentions, he suspended the sentence, the minimum possible sentence.
Are you acting with good intentions when it comes to the riots in Northern England, and your answer is racial discrimination?
I'm acting in good intentions in regards to the riot in Northern England when me and the British National Party stand up and give a voice to ordinary white people who nobody else listens to.
Your answer is to halt all further non-white immigration.
Indeed.
That's not an answer.
It's a start. When
these are British people who were fighting on the streets.
Yes, many of them. Yes.
They are British people. They have an equal right as you to be on the streets.
Yes.
Equal right to be here.
Yes.
Why do you want to encourage non-white immigrants to return to their lands of ethnic origin? By saying non-white, you're discriminating against
them. Yes,
for one reason, on the grounds of colour.
On the grounds of colour.
Which is pretty unacceptable these days, isn't it?
If you go to Oldham and Burnley and Bradford and parts of London, where our country has been totally changed without any democratic voice in it for ordinary people, then you'll find that it's just possible.
What do you mean without a democratic voice? People in this country vote overwhelmingly for parties that want racial harmony in this country.
The mass media, particularly the BBC, sets the political agenda so that when it comes to an election, people have a choice effectively between Tory and Labour.
It doesn't tell people what to vote for, does it?
No, it doesn't, but it sets the agenda whereby people think, well, what's acceptable to debate, or what are we debating this time around? So all the main parties at the last election agreed with the Commission for Racial Equality. They wouldn't even raise the issue of race. So that is not...
Are you complaining about the fact that the total number of votes received by right-wing parties in this country wouldn't even fill a big football stadium?
No, indeed. Indeed, I'm not.
So your views are...
Welcome to Voice of Albion on the White Network, John Tyndall, part 17 of 17. There was a West Midlands National Front meeting yesterday. After the first speakers, I said a few words about next week's White Man March. Some National Front activists said they'd like to take part, and we'll be flying the National Front flag on that day, as well as our mantra banner. So I'll let you know how that went next week. First there, you heard a video called Oldham Race Riots 2001. The war veteran they mentioned was beaten up by Muslims who had said the local park was a no-go area for whites. He wasn't just slightly beaten up. I remember at the time the guy was black and blue. And the second one you heard was a video called Burnley Race Riots, also in 2001. You hear the Commissioner for Racial Equality on that video called Shalid Malik, who's, you know, playing the victim there. Well, he's since called for a Muslim MP in Britain and said Inshallah, which means God willing in Arabic. So he's one of the fifth column of Muslims in this country who are getting as many MPs elected as possible, with the future aim of having a Muslim Prime Minister. Third, you heard Bradford Race Riots 2001. I'll post a link for the third video. At 1:30, you'll see a white lad running for his life, literally, as several Pakistanis beat him up and jump him. He almost got away, and then you hear on the video someone says, stop him. So somebody stands in his way, and then he's on the floor, and he doesn't get back up, and he's stabbed there. So notice in the documentary video, all these three are off Bravo, which is a British cable channel. Notice how the narrator limits as much as possible the quote-unquote Asians, that means Pakistanis over here, and makes very light work, doesn't sort of underline the war veteran who got beaten up, or the white lad who got stabbed. That's just very quickly mentioned. The fourth clip you heard, it was only about 6 or 7 minutes or so. The whole clip's 45 minutes. But that was Nick Griffin on Hard Talk. So I'll let sort of listeners make their own mind up of how well he done. But the reason I put that on was it was the same year as these three riots. So already in that video in 2001, you can kind of see him watering down the policy. You saw him straight away at the beginning saying he now believed in the Holocaust, when just 4 years earlier he said he didn't believe in it. If you watch the video, you'll also hear him sort of talking about violence that have been suffered by Hindus and blacks and this kind of stuff. So that's how he chose to use that time. And if you remember in the first episode of this series, I played the John Tyndall speech where he spoke in America, and he says, never ever deny the charge of racism. Well, that's also something else that Nick Griffin does in that interview. He starts saying, you know, really, I'm not a racist, we're not a racist. So you can kind of see where the problem was between Nick Griffin and John Tyndall within 2 years of Nick Griffin taking over the leadership. So at this time, John Tyndall wrote about Nick Griffin's changes to party ideology in his magazine Spearhead. In October 2001, John Tyndall published the following article entitled One Change Too Far. And because it's very relevant, I'm going to read the entire article, which is not that long. So the article is called One Change Too Far, subheading The BNP Leader Has Stated That He Believes An All-White Britain Is No Longer Possible. Spearhead Disagrees. Over the past 2 years, for reasons that should be obvious to most of our readers, Spearhead has been extremely sparing in its criticisms of the British National Party leadership. But this has not been good enough for some people. To them, even the mildest dissent from decisions made on behalf of the BNP is something to be stigmatised as sniping, sour grapes, rocking the boat, and even attacks on the party. To some, in the true spirit of Stalinism, frank and free internal debate would be better outlawed, and wherever it manifests itself, it should be given the label of treason. Although, if memories stretch back a little further than 2 years, it will be recalled that the very people who are hypersensitive to this kind of thing did a great deal of it themselves when they were seeking to obtain rather than being the occupants of the seats of power in the party. It has been the policy of this magazine to give these touchy souls the very minimum excuse to condemn us on the above grounds, while at the same time refusing to be silenced when anything happens which calls strongly for critical comment. Nick Griffin, when appearing at the count in Oldham for the announcement of the general election result, there wore a t-shirt bearing the words, gagged for speaking the truth. Well, the rule that there should not be a gag on the truth applies not just to some of us, but to all of us. We at Spearhead have in fact witnessed a number of developments in the BNP over the past year or two which have caused us deep unease. But we have often gagged ourselves when it has come to protesting about them rather than provide fuel for our opponents in the party to attack us for disloyalty. Committee for Ethnics. For instance, we have to say that we have never been very happy about the formation of a special circle attached to the BNP called the Ethnic Liaison Committee. The explained purpose of this circle is to enable cooperation between the party and non-white ethnic minority groups who favour its policy of stopping immigration and promoting voluntary repatriation. With the idea of such cooperation in itself, we have no quarrel. But in fact, under the previous party leadership, the occasional joint action with non-white groups was permitted. However, we felt that the concept had been taken a step too far with the setting up of a specific organisation which gave it a formal recognition which it had previously not enjoyed. Our principal reservation about this move was that, whatever protestations may be made on the contrary, it would be taken by many in the party to indicate something almost tantamount to the granting of membership status to its non-European participants. We know that this has been denied. The party has said of the circle that it means friends not family, cooperation not membership. Maybe so, but the fact remains that, to a substantial body of opinion in the BNP, it has been seen as the thin end of the wedge of admission of non-whites to the party. Such a view may well be unfounded, but nevertheless persists. Experience in the past has taught us that organisational innovations, which cause such apprehension and unrest amongst the membership, however rationally they may be explained, are to be avoided. The gut instincts of our members should never be lightly ignored, for it is the fuel that drives the party on. It is not true, incidentally, that this editor, that's John Tyndall, when BNP leader, ever consented to a half-Turkish person being admitted to BNP membership, although consent was given to his helping the party as a non-member. Nevertheless, despite our misgivings, the time the formation of the Ethnic Liaison Committee was announced, we did not loudly proclaim these misgivings in these columns or anywhere else. As we have indicated, our policy has always been to ration criticism as sparingly as possible. Salt in the soup. Later, another matter came to our notice, which gave rise to serious concern. In an article on the BNP in the Daily Mirror on the 29th of May this year, that would be 2001, Nick Griffin was quoted as using favourite metaphor of his to describe the presence of ethnic minorities in Britain. A little salt in the soup, he said, is okay. He was then reported as going on to say, if you have too much soup without any salt, it is frankly unpalatable, and salt makes the soup slightly more interesting. But if you put too much salt in the soup, then it is horrible. No possible construction could be put on these words but that Mr. Griffin finds unpalatable a Britain with no white ethnic minorities. That he thinks a Britain with some ethnic minorities is slightly more interesting, in quotes, but that with too many of the ethnic minorities the country will become horrible, in quotes. We could hardly believe our eyes as we read these words. Was Mr. Griffin actually being misquoted by the Daily Mirror writer, one Paul Byrne? We thought it only fair to ask him, and to this purpose a letter was dispatched to him by one of our contacts around the country, purporting to be an ordinary member of the public, and inquiring whether the words printed were actually what he said. Our contact never received a reply. Mindful always of the need to guard against Spearhead being seen as a platform for internal grumbles and the source of party disunity, we said nothing about this at the time, biting our tongues, so to speak, as so often we had done before. But now there has been a further development over which we feel we cannot maintain silence. In an interview on BBC, Three Counties Radio, at the beginning of last month, later relayed through several other stations and quoted extensively in newspapers, BNP leader Nick Griffin announced that he was looking for links with the Sikh community. Precisely what kind of links we do not know, but perhaps this would mean nothing more than the joint actions authorised by the previous party leadership, and referred to earlier in this article. At this stage, it would be premature to jump to conclusions. Well, a quick note there, you can see that John Tyndall recognised what Nick Griffin was up to, because if you fast forward to 2010, you actually had a Sikh person, a member in the 2010 election campaign video. And that was supposed to be our big election when we was going to break through and get MPs. Obviously that would have been unthinkable in 2001 when these words was written. So you can see how prophetic these words are. Multiculturalism accepted. But what gave far greater ground for concern and alarm was the accompanying statement made during the same interview that the BNP accepts that a non-whites only Britain was no longer possible and only wants to make the best of a bad job out of the multicultural society. As to the meaning of this statement, we cannot see that there could be more than one. That the BNP has now abandoned its commitment to the eventual achievement of an all-white Britain, that it accepts the multicultural society as an unchangeable fact, and that we must now grin and bear it and make the best of it. This, if correct, is fully in accordance with what Mr. Griffin appears to have said to the Daily Mirror in May, and it amounts to a betrayal of BNP activists and a repudiation of everything they have fought for over the past 19 years. Perhaps there will be some who will claim that these statements should not be taken too literally, that they are merely examples of clever tactics, that Mr. Griffin's purpose is no more than to fend off the charge that the BNP are racist, in quote, and that party supporters should understand this. But we would disagree. We believe that not only are such declarations wrong in principle, but, furthermore, they are not even politically clever. Of course, we recognise that sometimes things have to be said, or not said, publicly which do not totally reflect what politicians believe privately. Of course, we are aware that in the real world of politics, a straight line is not always the best route to a desired destination. Only 2 months ago, in a signed article in Spearhead, this editor acknowledged this in the context of another issue, saying, every moral imperative has to be evaluated in terms, among other things, of its practicability. Without political power, nothing moral can be done, and that which in pursuit of what is morally desirable renders political power forever out of reach is self-defeating. But we do not believe that this general rule of politics, valid though it is in some situations and other issues, justifies this quite shameful surrender in the name of the British National Party over what is perhaps the core principle of its entire political beliefs. Do those who defend this kind of nonsense suppose for one single moment that declarations like those of Mr. Griffin to the Daily Mirror and to Free Counties Radio will diminish in the slightest bit the implacable hostility of the media towards the BNP and their continued branding of its party of racists, in quotes? And did I not imagine for one moment that this kind of ingratiating waffle is going to impress the electors of places like Oldham, Burnley and London's Newer and Tower Hamlets? Just how many votes would have been won in Oldham as a result of the locals reading this tiny piece of small print in the Daily Mirror a few days before? We suspect very few, if any at all. Our votes in Oldham were achieved by what the locals saw on the streets with their own eyes in the way of Asians rioting and tearing their town apart. It is hardly likely that as these people behind their cars burning and their neighbours' windows being smashed, they had time for such niceties as salt in the soup. Wrong signals. On the other hand, declarations that the British National Party no longer aims at an all-white Britain and that its leader actually favours some ethnic minority presence, here as making the country more interesting, are going to send out all the wrong signals to the hardcore of its active membership, who have not sweated, sacrificed and battled for all these years past for anything less than a total restoration of their country to its indigenous white people. Contrary to all this nonsense, a whites-only Britain is indeed possible through a BNP victory, and without such a victory, not even any limited relief from the present multiracial horror will ever be possible. Needless to say, there are many views as to how this aim will be achieved, and we should listen to every such view that is presented in a sensible and civilised way. And there is no reason for the BNP to abandon its commitment, which it has always had, to achieve such a whites-only Britain by the most humane possible means. But the day we abandon our commitment to the aim itself will be the day for the abandonment of our party and all it stands for and has fought for. If some are willing to contemplate this magazine most certainly is not. Already, our telephone lines have been buzzing with angry comments on this latest piece of tampering with the party's principles, and we have received numerous requests for guidance as to what to do. Our response is very simple. We say to everyone, do not, under any circumstances and whatever your anger, entertain for one moment the idea of quitting the party. There is nowhere else to go. Other nationalist organisations are totally ineffective and are going nowhere. Splits and breakaways will achieve nothing, as recent evidence has shown and proved. This issue can only be resolved and must be resolved within the BNP. While strong emotions on this matter are understandable, emotions are never good guidelines for political action. Torn up or returned membership cards may not be something off the chest, may get something off the chest, but they accomplish nothing more, and they simply disempower people when it comes to doing something practical to put things right. And this is a matter which must, at all costs, be put right. So there you are, you can see you had all these riots in the north of England in 2001, which was making people turn to the British National Party. And just at that time, just at the one time when things should not be softened, that was exactly what Nick Griffin was doing. So now we'll go into chapter 19 of the 11th hour, which is called Scenario for War. As I explained in the last episode, we'll skip chapter 20, which is the BNP, as the information is a bit out of date. There are some interesting things in there, such as the British National Party bookshop, but probably best we skip that one. We'll finish the series today with the final chapter 21, The Way Ahead. So JT writes, for nearly half a century, recruiting campaigns for our armed forces made great play of what they called the defence of freedom. This was, of course, just a shorthand term for the group of countries which compromised the non-communist Western world and maintained institutions of parliamentary government. Whether there was, and is now, any reality in this freedom, in quotes, is a question that has been examined elsewhere in this book and will not concern us here. What concerns us, JC states, in this examination of defence policy is that the scenario of future war was very simply and neatly decided. It was going to be a war between the democracies, in quotes, led by the United States, and the communist world, led by Soviet Russia, and would most likely begin, if it began, with an attack by Soviet forces across the so-called Iron Curtain upon Western Europe. Defence planning was directed towards meeting such an attack. The armed forces of most of the nations of the Western world were for the main part organised into a single, integrated international body called the North Atlantic Treaty Organisation, NATO, which was always under the command of America, irrespective of whether he was the most qualified man for the job. In the case of nuclear weapons, only three Western countries had any producing capacities in this field: the United States, Britain and France, and this is still the case today. Instituted under President de Gaulle, the French policy had for some time been to maintain forces strictly under national control and, for the most part, national sources of supply, though available to be used in collaboration with other Western forces in the event of an attack on Western Europe. As part of this, France had insisted, and still does insist, on the maintenance of her own independent nuclear capability. Britain has retained her capacity to produce nuclear weapons, but increasingly has come to rely for her effective means of delivery of weapons supplied and largely controlled by the United States. JT points out that we have committed most of our resources to the purchase of nuclear weapons to the Trident missile system supplied by America at enormous expense. All this means that for nuclear weapons immediately available for use in Britain is heavily dependent on the United States, but does have the capacity to produce her own weapons should she need to. In the meantime, most of the training and conditioning of our armed forces is NATO orientated, with regular joint manoeuvres with other NATO forces. Servicemen are encouraged to see their primary role as the defence of what abstraction referred to as the free world, rather than the defence of their own nation and its interests. Even where they are engaged in purely British operations, such as in Northern Ireland, they are not seen to be defending British territory, but keeping the peace, in quotes, between two warring communities. Recent history, JT goes on, has demonstrated the folly of the rigid mentality which has placed most of our defence eggs in the basket of NATO. Against all the predictions of the self-appointed experts and professional theorists, the most important that Britain has had to face in recent times was not a NATO war, but a national one, arising from the fact that British territory alone was attacked and British forces alone were available to expel the attackers. The Falklands episode completely vindicated the nationalist view of defence needs, JT contends, and thoroughly discredited the internationalist one. Our expedition to liberate the Falklands from Argentina was by no means universally popular with our NATO allies, and from the start it was clear that we would have to undertake it and succeed in it by our own efforts. That we might in fact be faced with a war of this kind, while not wholly predictable, was much more so than any war in Europe along the lines for which our defence chiefs had planned. Yet when the Falklands War broke out, our preparedness for it was almost non-existent. Victory was achieved eventually, but the affair was, as the Duke of Wellington would have called it, a damned close-run thing. The first Napoleon is on record as saying that, in warfare, the psychological prevails in importance over the material in a ratio of about 3-1. Here, certainly, is a case where that rule applies. But, JT adds, we must indeed be prepared for a repetition of the events in the South Atlantic in 1982 and be ready to send task force again to that area at a moment's notice. Listeners may be aware that the Argentinian president has been calling for the Falklands to be returned to them, no doubt sensing Britain's growing weakness. Aside from this, JT continues, our main areas of concern should be the defence of the United Kingdom, including, of course, Northern Ireland, the security of Australasia, and the protection of and interests that we may re-establish in Africa. The rot in our armed forces, not long ago widely acknowledged as the world's best, reflects a deeper rot. One public relations advisor recently lecturing a Tory party symposium smugly announced that Britain was now a feminised culture. Sadly, there is much evidence that he was right, JT laments. Large numbers of young boys growing up with absent fathers lack suitable male role models and sources of authority. They go to primary schools where 80% of the teachers are women, many of whom are just not up to the job of imposing the necessary discipline on unruly male pupils, nor infusing them with the virtues of manliness they so sorely need at a crucial time of their development. As stated before, most of them experience much less in the way of tough sports than did their fathers and grandfathers. In the meantime, their out-of-school leisure hours are dominated by popular entertainment, TV movies and soaps and pop music, which complement the emasculating influences of the classroom. These days they are taught little or no history which breeds patriotism and national pride, or portrays the heroism of Britain's outstanding soldiers, sailors and airmen. Quick note on what JT says there. In the episode about Northern Ireland, we learned of the Ulster Regiment, who were the only ones to break through on the first day of the Somme offensive, and actually took prisoners. I've done GCSE and A-level history, both of which included World War I. Surely such an achievement should have been noted. It was not. JT then argues again that national service should be reintroduced to iron out these problems. I do believe Greece still has national service. I remember working with a woman who had a Greek boyfriend, and he'd been dodging national service while being in Britain. So they certainly did in the early 2000s. And I wonder if that has helped the brave nationalists of Golden Dawn surmount to all odds. JT continues, defence planning and organisation must take into account not only currently existing war needs of defence, but these needs likely to arise in the event of a major war. In that event, as stated, nearly the entire active manhood of the nation would have to be mobilised. It would also have to be mobilised and made fit for battle, probably in the shortest possible time. If every man liable for call-up in that contingency has already had 2 years' experience of service life, is accustomed to basic disciplines, knows how to handle weapons, and has had experience of some service trade or another, and it's a due proportion of such men have held some rank and are used to a degree of command and responsibility, the process of such a national mobilisation in time of war would be much quicker and smoother. The British soldier in World War II was often found to be lacking initiative when situations arose which had been planned for in his training, and these were many. Contrary to popular propaganda, his German adversary was much more or less of a blind automaton, reliant on orders from above. In training, JT asserts, men, even of the lowest rank, must be confronted with situations in which their superiors have been put out of action and they have to think on for themselves. This constant emphasis on the thinking soldier, the man of initiative, must permeate all training schedules. Essential to the maintenance of discipline and morale in any armed forces is an absolutely firm belief on the part of all members that they are serving something worth fighting for, and for which they would give their lives if necessary. JT's experience of national service was that there was no efforts made in talks to the men to inculcate belief in anything. There is not much sign that anything has changed, he adds. He does not believe that it is in the nature of young men to rush bravely into battle, prepared to die for world peace, in quotes, or world order, a multiracial society, or human rights. Land and people are things that millions will face death for, because they are concepts that can be felt and understood. Even Soviet Russia, with all its heretical allegiance to socialism, understood this and injected such sentiments into its young soldiers by all means necessary. Stalin discovered in World War II that his subjects would not fight for a political system, but would fight for their motherland. JT ends the chapter by saying, aside from the requirement of training men to serve their country in wartime, national service, as earlier remarked, is vitally necessary as a school for citizenship and for life. In this respect, it will be a continuation of the process begun in school and in youth organisations mentioned in an earlier chapter. The object must be to counteract all the potentially feminising influences in society that might infect young men at the most impressionable and vulnerable age of their lives. The values of manly pride, physical fitness, discipline and patriotism, fully absorbed at this crucial phase of entry from boyhood into manhood, will create a population in every way better fitted for the tasks of the future, peacetime as well as wartime. Recurring throughout this book has been the theme of building a stronger nation by means of a stronger people. I make no apology for the repetition, for the principle is crucial, JT writes. One of the most troubling of modern phenomena is the very large number of young men we are today producing whose faces, voices, carriage, physique and attributes betray a depressing wimpishness and softness. I firmly believe that the effete political and spiritual doctrines that have come to hold sway in contemporary Britain are not unconnected with this national decline in manhood. The decline has to be stopped, and a new type of man made of our ideal. Service in fighting forces is a part, not the only part, but a vitally important one, of the process of building this new man. This, above all things, is why it must become recognised as an absolute national necessity. So that's the end of the chapter scenario for war. We'll have a 5 minute break. I'll play Ralph Vaughan Williams' London Symphony. Ralph Vaughan Williams is an English composer who does the piece at the start of the programme, which is called 17 Come Sunday, part of the English folk suit. But the London Symphony is 45 minutes long, so I'll just play the first 5 minutes and then we'll do the next chapter. So if you want to listen to the whole piece, just search for Ralph Vaughan Williams' London Symphony. Okay, welcome back, listeners. I hope you enjoyed that little piece of European classical music. And that's what I'll call it, European classical music, not classical music, because that's what it is. I know John Tyndall was a fan of European classical music, so do check out Ralph Vaughan Williams if you'd like to hear a good English composer. Another one I would recommend is Edward Elgar, who is probably more better known. On to chapter one then, The Way Ahead. John Tyndall writes, "We live in a society that is terminally sick in the manner of a political, economic, social and spiritual AIDS, lacking the built-in natural immunity that is to be found in all healthy body organisms. It is vulnerable to every germ and shock that the world climate may blow its way. For this society, every week is a crisis, as it wriggles vainly to cope with some fresh problem arising from out of its own insoluble internal tensions and contradictions. Its death is certain. The only remaining uncertainty is that of the precise moment it expires. It is a society whose entire structure is built on foundations of untruth. Firstly, there is the regular diet of lies ladled out to the people concerning the meaning of the daily events reported in newspapers. On those occasions, by no means the rule when such events are allowed to be reported at all. Secondly, there is the dishonesty concerning the nature of the society and political system under which we live. A dishonesty by which it is proclaimed as part of daily catechism that we are all free people, in quotes, whereas we are in reality slaves, spiritually incarcerated within prison walls of conformity, which most of us can't see. Only those of us know those walls are there who have made the effort to venture beyond them. Day in, day out, when trains do not run, when school teachers do not educate, when inner city mobs are rioting, and when national assets are being sold off to the highest foreign bidder, the soothing lullaby is purred into our ears that we must consider ourselves lucky, because we enjoy a heritage of freedom, in quotes, but in the end, when the sleep is washed from our eyes, we find that this freedom consists of no more than the faculty to make a cross every so often, facility to mark a cross every so often, beside the name of one or other of the ventriloquists, dolls of Parliament or Town Council, seated on the knee of the grinning Moloch of money power, who pays all the party pipers and calls all the tunes. Finally, there is the supreme untruth concerning the nature of our world and history, which has become standard teaching everywhere. In every aspect of contemporary British politics, the habit is to try to square the circle, to make work that which will not work. The present form of parliamentary democracy, in quotes, as a method for the translation of the popular will into political action, has become a stable joke. Yet the greater the evidence of this, the greater the intransience with which the system is defended, and the shriller the cry of wolf against those who question it. An economic doctrine which has emaciated industry and delivered millions to idleness is persisted in, as if there is no other conceivable alternative. The response to inner city deterioration is yet more promises of open checks bearing the signature of the taxpayer, while everyone with a wit to rub against the other knows that money has almost nothing to do with the problem. Pious speeches against mounting crime are of a weekly ritual, while those making them know in their bones that, within the limits of what is acceptable policy, nothing will be done to reverse the trend. Meanwhile, JT points out, the lunacy of race equality has become the national religion in a manner reminiscent of pre-Reformation frenzy, with every unbeliever a candidate for the stake. And in the global field, the phantom of internationalism and one world paralyze all searchings for a policy that will ensure British survival. In the great institutions of state, an abiding putrescence is everywhere. The councils of every imaginable public body are packed with squalid, mediocre little time servers drawing inflated salaries and expenses, what they reduce to shambles almost every enterprise they undertake. About our political leaders, JT states, there is a depressing sameness which transcends superficial party differences as they list the familiar slogans of the parliamentary custard pie fight that everyone has heard a thousand times before. There are, of course, without exception, merely sales assistants, messenger boys and clerks, working in the service of much more powerful people who, behind the scenes, determine real policy. The little tricks that they try to pull over each other in order to score points in the party game are nauseating to the nostrils of anyone with the instinct to perceive the reality of national decay surrounding them. The political rot, however, is only part of a much more general rot. Our entire national life is in the grip of degenerative forces which barely leave one small area of affairs unaffected. As they run amok, like maggots invaded a diseased carcass, filtering through everywhere as resistance wanes. As JT indicated in an earlier chapter, from Cornwall to Caithness, from Londonderry to Kent, as the daily toll ends and the working members of the family return home, the press of a little knob condemns the nation to another evening of poison, spewed out into every drawing room by highly specialised professionals, lawyers, misinformers, mindbenders and traders in diet and drivel. By this technique, and in a manner perceptible only to an informed few, a once rigorous and healthy race is being alienated from its roots, robbed of its heritage and held spiritual captive while being deluded that it enjoys liberty, in quotes. Having stated these facts, JT writes, I would be wrong to say that they are not widely recognised. Indeed, they are a regular topic of conversation almost everywhere where normal people meet and talk. He claims no novelty in such a diagnosis of the national situation. Even in our controlled daily press, admission of the state of things, albeit very incomplete, is by no means unknown. I'll just say British readers of the Daily Mail will see exactly what John Tyndall's talking about there. You've almost got hundreds and hundreds of commenters are basically speaking nationalist policy, nationalist beliefs, but this never happens at the voting booths. But what is not fully grasped, JT contends, is the depth of the root of the sickness and the radical nature of the means needed to overcome it. Too many people still see and talk about only the symptoms of what is wrong. Only a few are prepared to give their minds to the causes, and fewer still to the causes of the causes. It is JT's conviction that if we really are to understand the ills of Britain, we must see them as the logical and inevitable result of a process of faulty national development extending well back into the previous century. That would be the 19th century, as he was writing in 1998. Institutions do not lend themselves to infiltration, takeover and internal corruption on the present scale unless they possess in the first place some fundamental weakness. Likewise, JT adds, the fashionable doctrines of national degeneracy that hold such wide sway today could never have infected a climate of ideas that was basically healthy. On liberalism, JT writes, what many people regard as the lunatic left, for instance, is a growth that first needed fertile soil for its germination. That soil existed in the atmosphere of liberalism that preceded the growth and in a system of values which in that atmosphere had gained widespread acceptance in our society. It was liberalism which, over many decades, undermined belief in a strong state authority, thus removing society's armour against all the forces of subversion within the national borders. It was liberalism which hastened moral deterioration and the atrophy of clear and robust thought, helping to create legions of sick morons who have now become the commissars of our town councils and our world of education. It is liberalism that lowers society's defences against the Marxist infection by paralysing that society's faculty for recognising its enemies, to say nothing of its will to fight and defend them. If we are seriously to grapple with the chaos of the present day and formulate a creed and movement for national rebirth, our thinking must begin with an utter rejection of liberalism and a dedication, as stated earlier, to what Spengler called the resurgence of authority. As such, it must entail the embrace of a political outlook which is, in relation to the present, revolutionary. At a Conservative conference in the 1980s, JT recalls, Mrs. Thatcher called for her party to enter a crusade. That is certainly what is needed, JT states, but equally, certainly conservatism is incapable of making it. Just a look around at the faces at any Tory conference hall will reveal that they are not those of people who are crusading material by the wildest stretch of the imagination. And a look at the most recent Conservative election manifesto will show that it was about as much crusading flavour as a shopping list. The policies set out in this manifesto appeal only to material ambition, selfishness and greed. They are unheroic. They are static. And it is precisely a creed of heroism that is needed now to turn the tide of British history at this 11th hour. A creed that will call forth all the finest attributes of manhood that sent our forebears across the oceans in their small boats in the drive to empire. A creed that will unite the British nation into a true community capable of undertaking the gigantic works of national reconstruction to which we must apply ourselves if we are to make a future. A creed by which we have achieved a new renaissance of the British genius in all the creative arts and sciences and heal back the forces of decadence that now threaten to engulf us. JT writes, he has attempted in this book to present the outlines of such a creed. The book is not an election manifesto, although victory at elections must be the ultimate means by which we attain the power to act. The book makes no attempt to pander to the idiocies and prejudices that are the political currency of the moment. It is addressed to a select circle of people in Britain with minds unrestricted by conventional boundaries of debate, people who are seriously concerned for posterity and are prepared to work for it. It will be recognised from what has been written that the doctrine being put forward is much more than just political. It embraces every aspect of the life of the nation and its members, for nothing less than a total reformation of personal as well as national values can bring about the renewal that we need. Indeed, it is written, it is within the individual that this renewal must begin. No revolutionary change in society can occur except through every person aspiring to that change first undergoing a revolution within himself. This means an adjustment, when necessary, to new habits of living as well as to new values. It means a wholesale rejection of our contemporary civilization with its worship of the deformed, the diseased and the decayed, and the quest for a new order of truth and beauty built by a higher breed of people. In every way possible, we must draw from the best of our own national traditions the inspiration for the movement of British revival of which we are part. Every great nation must stage its own awakening in its own way, with methods appropriate to its own particular national character and genius. In an earlier chapter, JT related his brief involvement in, and later in his decisive rejection of, politics resting on imported terminology, paraphernalia and symbolism, with its pantheon of heroes who, whatever their merits or demerits, have no part of our history. Nevertheless, it is inevitable that parallels are going to be drawn between at least some of the policies we advocate for national reconstruction in Britain and policies carried out in similar fields by nations at other times, with the lumping of all together under some blanket description, the most popular of which is fascism, in quotes. Our opponents, JT points out, will see to it that this is done, whatever we may do or say to the contrary. So what is fascism? It is a word of Italian origin used to describe the programme carried out in Italy by Mussolini between 1922 and 1943. It is no part of our language and we do not need it. Be that as it may though, fascism has entered the dictionary as a term employed to cover almost every conceivable kind of patriotic and national doctrine of the 20th century, and in so doing has lost all its original precision. Today it means just another anything that people want it to mean, according to their viewpoint. JT contends there are two extremes of reaction to this state of affairs, and both are equally foolish. One is to copy to the letter the name, program, symbols and ritual used by some foreign movement of the past, be it that of Mussolini or Hitler, and attempt to resurrect it right down to the last belt buckle. The other is to jump like a scalded cat and bolt in panic in the opposite direction, trying so hard to prove to the world that one is not a fascist or a Nazi, that one abandons one firm political conviction after another to the point at which there is none left. Nothing creates such a pathetic spectacle as those people who live in daily dread of being branded as fascists or Nazis, and are thus deterred from adopting any robust principles of politics at all. We should reject both these foolish courses, JT concludes, and be prepared to look at every political idea on its merits, regardless of the names people give to it, and regardless of who may have adopted it, wholly or partially, in the past. We must see today's professional anti-fascists and anti-Nazis, in quotes, for what they are, people whose purpose is to impose a psychological terror which puts an end to all rational thought and discussion about anything. In a similar way to the anti-racism spoken of earlier, we must not allow the process of public debate to be controlled according to these people's rules. If British people generally are going to take effective action to win back control of their country and rebuild its prosperity and strength, they must first decide to immunise themselves psychologically against the shock impact of the fascist label. There is absolutely no chance of doing anything meaningful to help the patriotic cause while escaping this label, and so everyone may as well learn to live with it and not worry about it. Indeed, one of the barriers that has to be overcome is that of convincing people that there simply is no easy and comfortable way of winning the battle. A great many people would like to see the victory of a patriotic movement in Britain, but delude themselves that there is some route to this objective in which we can duck away from the orchestrated vituperation of the nation's destroyers. No such routes exist. As the old system slides further into anarchy and chaos, the moment for the emergence of a dynamic new force in British politics draws nearer. The second major obstacle is a strong indisposition on the part of many British people, not only towards political action, but towards political radicalism of any kind. This observation is today true of white Western peoples generally, but it is particularly true of our own people. A consequence of this national temperament is that great political changes, when they occur in our country, do not occur quickly. The first Labour government in Britain, for instance, was formed in 1924. The idea of British socialism, however, had been present in these islands for much longer. Its development extended back into the distant midst of the 19th century. British nationalism, like British socialism, has been no overnight growth. It would be wholly wrong, JT argues, to draw from this, as some pessimists do, that because nationalism has not in all these years achieved political power, or even won widespread mass support, it cannot do so in the future. Such a conclusion would be mistaken, now as it was about socialism earlier in the 20th century. The pioneers of socialism had it to wait with patience for their movement, for their moment of destiny, allowing natural historical forces to make possible the advent of socialism as a power factor in Britain. The important thing is that, when that moment arrived, socialists had ready the political machine needed to exploit it, and thus turn into a potent political force what had previously only been an idea, and a vision in the minds of a comparative few. Exactly the same rules governs the coming of the moment of destiny for our movement. Running constantly throughout this book has been the theme of an enemy within, contriving the destruction of British nationhood, and the manner in which that enemy has been portrayed may well convey the impression of formidable power, intruding into every corner of British life. That power should certainly not be underestimated. We would be in grave error, however, if we fell into the trap of regarding it as omnipotent. Evident everywhere in the system is the proof of its weakness. the meagre calibre of public men that it brings to the fore, its puerile level of public debate, its terror of allowing into that debate people and ideas to which it has no answer, its manifest failure in every branch of national affairs to which its resources have been applied. Concomitant to this, we should not underestimate the potentiality, titanic strength of the forces opposed to what is being done within the system, and which belong in fact on our side. These include many tens of thousands of ordinary members of not only the Conservative Party, but the Labour and other parties too, not to forget the many active and public-spirited people in the ranks of Ulster Unionism in its various factions. Finally, we should not exclude those thousands who have been active in the nationalist movement in the past but subsequently dropped out, not because they had changed their opinions or sentiments, but because of their frustration at a failure to break through into the big time, in quotes, of politics as quickly as they would have hoped. All these elements amount to what is potentially a gigantic army of national resistance and resurgence. It only needs to be mobilised in a single and coordinated force for political action. Somewhere, JT predicts, a cataclysm must and will emerge that will bring about this mobilisation. When it comes, the force it will represent will be irresistible. On the subject of money, JT writes, patriots of the British race must learn something from the example of those other races, notably the Jews, whose money power has set up the juggernaut of world Zionism. Zionism today is powerful, some would say all-powerful, precisely because within Jewish communities everywhere there is ample number of people prepared to put huge funds at the disposal of those who operate the international Zionist power machine. As long as this remains a fact, and as long as those who are the victims of this power machine are unprepared to put their own money where their sentiments are and finance a machine to counter it, it could be said that there is some justice, however disagreeable to us, in the hegemony that the Zionists enjoy. Just half a dozen patriotic millionaires prepared to make available a mere 10% of their wealth to finance the nationalist movement in this country would make possible a huge stride forward in that movement's development. On our struggle, being a global one, JT writes, our creed and cause, though they must begin with nationalism, must ultimately rise beyond nationalism to serve the paramount interests of race. This does not mean a repudiation of the national idea and the search for a world order, in quotes, of the kind that are present mode and which have firmly been rejected in this book. What it does mean is that our national concept must attain a maturity not present in some of those older ones which sets one white Western civilization against stretches of territory against each other, sometimes in dispute over stretches of territory, minute in proportion to the overall racial blood sacrifice in which such conflicts resulted. For it is the West, the true West, and not just Britain and the lands of her overseas kindred, that is in deadly danger. The danger was seen by Oswald Spengler early in the 20th century and set out in his monumental work, The Decline of the West. Spengler was a German and a nationalist, but his vision and concern extended far beyond Germany and embraced the whole racial family of which his own nation, like ours, is put. His thesis was that Western civilization, like others before it, had its natural lifespan, and that the West was coming to the end of its lifespan, having been drained of all the vital life forces that had given its former strength and dominance. Spengler saw as symptoms of this impending death political liberalism, internationalism, and a dominance of money over politics. And he saw in the modern city, particularly, the quintessence of all the degenerative tendencies making for this creeping demise. He further saw in the modern intellectual the quintessential occupant of that city. Speaking of this relationship, he said, no wretchedness, no compulsion, not even a clear vision of the madness of this development avails to neutralise the attractive force of these demonic creations. Once the full sinful beauty of this last marvel of all history has captured a victim, it never lets go. Primitive folk can lose themselves from the soil and wander, but the intellectual nomad never. Homesickness for the great city is keener than any other nostalgia. Home is for him any of these giant cities, but even the nearest village is alien territory. He would sooner die upon the pavement than go back to the land. Even disgust at this pretentiousness, wearing of the thousand-hued glitter, the tedium vitae that in the end overcomes many, does not set them free. They take the city with them into the mountains or on the sea. They have lost the country within themselves and will never regain it outside. Expanding on the same theme, Spengler then perfectly summed up the crisis of civilization created through the reign of urban intellectualism throughout most of the Western world, saying, "And then, when being is sufficiently uprooted and waking being sufficiently strained, there suddenly emerges into the bright light of history a phenomenon that has long been preparing itself on the ground and now steps forward to make an end of the drama, the sterility of civilized man. This is not something that can be grasped as a plain matter of casualty, as modern science naturally enough has tried to grasp it. It is to be understood as an essentially metaphysical turn towards death. The last man of the world city no longer wants to live. He may cling to life as an individual, but as a type, as an aggregate, no. For it is characteristic of this collective existence that it eliminates the terror of death. That which strikes the true peasant with an inexplicable fear, the notion that the family and the name may be extinguished, has now lost its meaning. The continuance of the blood relation in the visible world is no longer a duty of the blood, and the destiny of being the last of the line is no longer felt as a doom. Children do not happen, not because children have become impossible, but principally because intelligence at the peak of intensity can no longer find any reason for their existence. Let the reader try to merge himself into the soul of the peasant. He has sat on his glebe from primeval times, or has fastened his clutch in it, to adhere to it with his blood. He is rooted in it as the descendant of his forebears, and as the forebear of future descendants. His house, his property, means, here, not the temporary connection of person and thing for a brief span of years, but an enduring and inward union of eternal land and eternal blood. It is only from this mystical conviction of settlement that the great epochs of this cycle, procreation, birth and death, derive that metaphysical element of wonder which condenses in the symbolism of custom and religion that all landlord people possess. For the last man, all this is past and gone. Intelligence and sterility are allied in old families, old peoples and old cultures. Not merely because in each microcosm the overstrained and fettered animal element is eating up the plant element, but also because in the waking consciousness the being is normally regulated by casualty. That which the man of intelligence most significantly and characteristically labels as natural impulse or life force, he not only knows but values casually, giving it the place among his other needs that his judgment assigns to it. When the ordinary thought of a cultivated people begins to regard having children as a question of pros and cons, the great turning point has come. For nature knows nothing of pro and con. Everywhere life is actual, reigns as inward organic logic, and it a drive that is utterly independent of waking being, with its casual linkages, and indeed not even observed by it. The abundant proliferation of primitive peoples is a natural phenomenon, which is not even thought about, still less judges it to utility or the reverse. When reasons have to be put forward that an all-in-all question of life, life itself has become questionable. At that point begins prudent limitation of the numbers of births. In the classical world, the custom was deplored by Polybius as the ruin of Greece, and yet even at this date it had long been established in the great cities. In subsequent Roman times it became appallingly general. At first explained by the economic misery of the times, very soon it ceased to explain itself at all, and at that point too, in Buddhist India, as in Babylon, in Rome, as in our cities, a man's choice of the woman who is to be, not mother of his children, as among peasants and primitives, but his own companion for life, becomes a problem of mentalities. The Ibsen marriage appears, the higher spiritual affinity in which both parties are free. Free, that is, as intelligences, free from the plant-like urge of the blood to continue itself, and it becomes possible for Rousseau to say that unless woman repudiates her womanliness, her duty to her husband, to her children, to society, to the law, and to everyone but herself, she cannot emancipate herself. JT continues, in the last lines here we find an echo of modern woman's objection to the restoration of the anti-abortion laws. In her claim that she has a right, in quotes, to decide to do what with her body. Of course, just as everyone has the right to destroy his or her own health by dissolute living, so long as, in the ethics of liberalism, it does not harm one's neighbour. Gone is the duty to posterity, to the blood, to the task of continuance of family and race, which Spengler pinpointed in the quoted passage. In the individual, there is still the will to life, but in the stock, there is only the will to extinction. The one central weakness in Spengler's analysis, JT writes, is that he did not anticipate the revolutionary changes against these death forces that were to occur later in the century, and which serve as signposts from which we can draw the inspiration and the understanding there exists a lifeline for the renewal of our civilization, that there is for the grasping, if we can summon the determination to fight our way to the attainment of it. Spengler was writing mostly around the First World War, so John Tyndall, I presume, is talking about he didn't predict the rise of the Third Reich, basically. We can, in other words, prove Spengler wrong in his assertion that the West is finished, for the remedy to it, potentially, terminal sickness is indeed available, contrary to his own supposition when he wrote his epitaph. JT writes, I have attempted in this book to make some contribution towards the ideas that will form the basis of our own British movement of rebirth and awakening that must take its place, alongside others, in a desperately needed renaissance of the West. Many of these ideas will seem strange, even outlandish, to those whose minds are still shackled within the perimeters of contemporary debate. In the foreword of this book, I have stated my task as being to point forward to new horizons of political thought and action. I hope that to those whom the book is addressed will see in these horizons a vision of grandeur, for it is not grandeur that has become despised, almost laughed at, commodity in the politics of today. Preoccupied as these are by the small and the mean, by the petty perspectives of the petty people who rule over them, we are told to deride as dangerous the dreams of grandeur and greatness, yet it is not such dreams that have inspired all the multi movements of men and ideas that have propelled the world towards since the dawn of recorded history. Let us never dismiss these grand visions from our souls, for without them we become merely the lotus-eating remnants of exhausted nations and cultures. Let us acknowledge the fact that we fight for the coming of a new age of grandeur, beside which the present will appear as a mere anthill at the side of the road of British destiny. Let us march to the music of grandeur as we proceed along that road, and let the ideals of grandeur be the guiding stars as we call from within us those needed reserves of human resolve and spirit to sustain us in the epic struggle against the powers of decay that confront us at every bend. This book has been given its title because of my belief that our country and people are approaching a time of supreme decision and supreme reckoning, at which, if the wrong path is taken, we will be committed to a course of self-destruction from which there will be no possibility of turning back. Will Britain take the course and lapse into a twilight age in which all vital forces of the national genius are extinguished, and in which she abdicates from the world scene, immersing herself in ever more frivolous pleasures and childish amusements while history is made elsewhere? Will the degeneration of national life that has been evident for most of the present century, that's the 20th century, and its accelerating speed since World War II, continue unabated, while small-time political careerists, posers and shysters carry on their squalid and pathetic party fight like hers of fallen drunk dukedom, battling for the few pots and pans remaining of the family estate. Or will we take the alternative road, the road of resurgence and renewal, hurling back the degenerative forces in a mighty effort of the national will, and asserting again the qualities of manhood that in past ages gave us world leadership? The vital question will be answered and resolved by our generation and the one following it, and we should count it a privilege that we live in a time of great decision, a time that does not permit escape from the hard realities of historical choice, but throws us down at the crossroads of destiny and confronts us with the options, life or death, future or extinction. The manly fight for national rebirth, or the resigned acceptance of the descent into senility, ending with the expiry of every real asset of nationhood and every inheritance of race. This book is addressed to those who have already made the former choice, and to those many more whose instinct is to make it. If given the opportunity, nowhere have I concealed the fact that the road ahead for us is long and hard, and the pitfalls dangerous. We face the concentrated enmity and fury of the whole of the old world of politics. We face the lies and distortions of a corrupt press. We face the violence of the hate-crazed red mob. We face the apathy born of illusions of security and affluence. All these obstacles make our mission a hazardous one, which will demand from us the highest exertions of staying power and valour of which man is capable. Our creed is one of heroism, and the coming epoch calls for the return of the heroic virtues. Not for us the cosy tranquillity of the political soft option, for us only the long march through the cold night which must precede the glorious dawn. These conditions demand the special quality of steel in those who rally to our banner, and if the forthrightness of the message put forward in this book frightens and puts off the delicate of fibre and of spirit, that is good, for their place not with us, and we should not wish to encumber ourselves with their presence. Today, from out of the chaos and the ruin wrought by the old politics, new men are rising. These new men of the new age are now working night and day across the land to forge the sinews of the movement to which their lives and mine are dedicated. Above them, as they work, are the spiritual legions of mighty ancestors, whose bones lie at the bottom of the oceans and beneath the soil of five continents, where the men and women of our blood have borne the British flag and stamped the mark of British genius. Today we feel the voices of these past generations calling down to us in sacred union, urging us to be worthy of their example and their sacrifice. To them we owe it to fight on, and to their all, so that a great land and a great race may live again in splendour. So that's the end of The 11th Hour by John Tyndall. John Tyndall died in 2005 and was joined by his wife Valerie in 2011. Heritage and Destiny, a British nationalist magazine, write about Valerie Tyndall. She was never disillusioned, although frequently disgusted, by the antics of the Griffinite cabal, that twice sought to expel and even proscribe her husband. After this latter prescription, she was amused to be told that as a BNP member, she was required to shun all contact with the proscribed individual. During her 6 years as a widow, and as one of the few surviving founder members of the BNP, Valerie remained a loyal supporter of Richard Edmonds' efforts to rescue the party. She will be there in spirit when a post-Griffin movement rises from the wreckage. That's the end quote. As people, well, John Tyndall also, and other rare people who have led British nationalism with determination and dignity over the decades past, will also be with us in spirit. I'd like to just say thank you to those who have posted these John Tyndall podcasts on their own websites. These sites include The British Resistance, The Daily Stormer, Hardon's Blog, Grism.com, The West's Darkest Hour, JewishProblem.com, and any others I've missed out. In future, I'll be doing a mixture of interviews with white nationalists and podcasts on relevant subjects. I'm now going to play out with a short clip entitled John Tyndall Humour, because I don't think John Tyndall, although he was a serious man and, you know, a warrior, I don't think he would want us to lose that humour either. So, thanks for listening. Take care. 14 words.
We had some people after the 1979 election who said, well, the thing to do is infiltrate the Tory party. That's the clever way. Everybody votes Tory, so let's infiltrate the Tory party. And so they left the ranks of active nationalism, joined their Tory constituency associations, all congratulating themselves on how clever they were. Well, in just two or three years, certainly by the election of 1983, they'd all been rumbled and they were all out in their ears. The Tories won't fall for that one. They may be stupid, but they're not quite as stupid as that. Infiltrating the Tories will never work. And the idea of converting the Tory party to nationalism, that is about as practical as the idea that I should be nominated for presidency of the State of Israel.
Thanks for listening to Voice of Albion on the White Network.